Case number 20-3289, Nicholas Merriweather v. Francesca Hartop, et al. Argument not to exceed 25 minutes for plaintiff, 15 minutes for defendants, and 10 minutes for interveners. Mr. John Bursch, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Bursch on behalf of Dr. Merriweather. I have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. Officials at Shawnee State punished and chilled Dr. Merriweather by compelling him to speak the university's message and prohibiting from saying what he wanted to express, both on and off campus. Dr. Merriweather tried repeatedly to find a compromise that would not force him to say anything he believed to be untrue while still showing respect for his student. But after initially accepting a compromise, officials changed position and rejected every alternative, even forbidding Dr. Merriweather from expressing his views in his syllabus. As this court said in Julia Ward versus Polite, tolerance on public campuses is a two-way street, but at Shawnee State, that street only runs one way. The district court erred in dismissing this lawsuit. First, it declined to recognize that in Hardy, this court already held that college faculty have speech rights when teaching, and Garcetti does not disturb that holding. Second, the court wrongly concluded that sex-reflective pronouns and titles do not communicate a message on an issue of public importance. The Supreme Court in Janus said that gender ideology is an issue of public importance. And if pronouns did not communicate something about gender ideology and Dr. Merriweather's views on it, there would be no need to ban his explanation in the syllabus. This court should reverse.
On the free speech claim, can I ask you, assume we agree with you that Garcetti does not apply to academic speech, how far does that extend? Would it go to teaching, to scholarship, to administrative tasks, how far?
Well, as the Fourth Circuit said in Lee, you go to the status quo ante in the particular circuit that you're in. So in the Sixth Circuit under Hardy, that would include teaching and it would include scholarship, but it would likely not include administration. So that means administrative duties or even things like setting the syllabus or picking the course book would still be the university prerogative. But when you're talking about the professor's speech in the classroom or in their scholarship, the First Amendment says that at a minimum, you'd have to go through the Pickering balancing test.
What about if the university wanted you to do a roll call? Would that be on the teaching method side or would that be on the speech side?
I think that would be on the administrative side because they would need to have some ability to know what students were in the classroom in order to know how to give credit.
What if during the roll call, they instructed you to use the pronoun of the student's choice?
Well, that's where you run into the problem that we ran into here. Now you're putting words in the professor's mouth on an issue of great public importance where it's communicating something about his views and taking the allegations in the complaint.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. One more question. Okay, so I get that, but why, if you're doing an administrative task and they tell you how to do it, are you really teaching? I mean, you see what I'm trying to get at is where is that line? Where does it cross over into the categories you've given us, and where does it stay in the administrative tasks / teaching methods, as Judge Sutton described in Frieder?
Yeah, I think it's difficult, but you know, maybe one example would be Judge Sutton's conclusion that when you give a grade, that is within the function of the teaching, not the administration, but communicating that grade to the student would be on the administrative side. So, you know, is it a bright line? I'm not sure about that. But certainly anytime that the university is putting words in the professor's mouth or ordering them to be silent on a particular subject, that has to fall on the teaching side.
Could they do it? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could they do it with a basketball coach? Go ahead.
Basketball, obviously, a vastly different situation because their primary duty isn't going to be back and forth instruction the way that you are in a classroom. Now, even there, I think the university...
Basketball coaches would take issue with that, but okay.
They would, but you know, think about the course of the game. You know, they're yelling out instructions and things like that. But say that a lot of universities have done this. They've instructed their athletic coaches to have a discussion with their students about Black Lives Matter. And if the coach had a particular view about Black Lives Matter, I don't think the university could prohibit them from expressing their view or force them to use the university's words to express the university's view on that topic without being able to respond to it. And here, it's not just a matter of the pronouns themselves. The university told Dr. Merriweather he couldn't even explain his views in the syllabus. This is as broad a teaching point, a viewpoint, as you could possibly get to. And if they can tell a professor that you can't even discuss this in the syllabus, then of course he can't bring it up in any kind of meaningful way in a classroom discussion. He has been silenced, and obviously on an issue of public importance.
So would the university have been within its rights to give the professor the instructions to use the preferred pronoun if they had allowed him to explain his position on that in the syllabus?
The Hurley case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided would say that that's not enough to prevent the First Amendment violation, that simply allowing someone to explain themselves while the government forces them to speak the government's message is still a First Amendment violation. But as we discussed at length in the complaint in the brief, Dr. Merriweather was trying his utmost to find a way that he could speak the truth while still respect the student. And it's possible they could have found some common ground there. Now, that wasn't an offer he made. He was just inquiring to see what the extent of the university's speech restrictions would be. But even there, you run into a Hurley problem.
Mr. Birch, I have a hypothetical for you. So it says in 1 Timothy, a woman should learn in quietness and full submission. So right there, St. Paul's letter to Timothy. So the professor takes this to heart, and the professor has a view that women should not speak in while learning. So he never calls on the women in his class, just does not do it. Only calls on men. He teaches the same way as Dr. Merriweather does, Socratic method, but doesn't call on the women. And he's making a point. It's in accordance with his religious teaching and also his academic views. Or is he now not doing his job?
Well, yeah, first I would ask what that topic has to do with the course that he's teaching. Here, Dr. Merriweather would talk to his students about human sexuality and its meaning as part of a philosophy course, which you would expect. But even moving past that, at some point, you do start to run into the school's interest. And that's articulated in the Supreme Court's Davis versus Monroe County case. There has to be a problem on the professor's end that's so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that the student is effectively denied their educational benefit. Now, when students aren't allowed to participate in class because the professor won't call on them based on their views on women in the classroom, now you're denying an educational benefit. And so the Pickering balancing is going to look very, very different. But conversely, if you would agree with the university's position in this case, they would have the ability to compel the professor to say anything they want. They could compel the professor to instruct the students that women shouldn't be in class and should stay silent. They could instruct the professor that they have to give the university's views on Black Lives Matter. They could even tell a law professor, for example, that they have to profess that Justice Amy Coney Barrett is anti-LGBT because of her religious beliefs. You know, and we just know from common sense that that can't possibly be educational benefit. The school's view would prevail.
Can I ask one follow-up? So your initial reaction was to cabinet because the speech here, my hypothetical non-speech of the women, doesn't relate to the course. But do you want to embrace that limitation? Or do you think that if Dr. Merriweather taught calculus, he also could not be compelled to call on people by their preferred pronouns?
Well, it certainly depends on the issue. You know, just this week, the University of Wyoming announced that they were going to introduce diversity training, including discussions about microaggressions, into their geoscience curriculum. And so it wouldn't be uncommon that you might have discussions about LGBT rights or other issues in a math class or a science class. So, you know, I don't want to say that somehow could be excluded. On the other hand, when you're talking about a philosophy professor who as a regular part of his class, his substantive class, talks about these issues, this is the easiest possible case when you're doing the Pickering balance.
So is that the line? I mean, I guess I'm looking for, like, which line do you want us to, if we were to rule in your favor, how do you want us to draw the line? You want us to say, this pertains to philosophy professors when they're talking about, they're teaching courses that are related to the subject matter, or it applies to all professors across math and science and engineering? And
yeah, that's a great question, Judge Larson. The problem here with any kind of a bright line rule, as Judge Sutton has already observed in this context, is that you do have two competing rights. You have the First Amendment rights of the college professor, and then you have the administrative rights and the need to be efficient and to say what the course curriculum is on the side of the college. And so drawing bright lines is difficult, and that's why the Supreme Court gives us the Pickering balancing test. And I think you already have the precedent that says how that test should look in a context like this one, and that's the Hardy case. Okay, so Hardy obviously concerned racist and sexist language, very offensive in the classroom. And yet this court concluded that the First Amendment rights of the professor outweighed any college interests in eliminating offensiveness in the classroom or even preserving their enrollment. And so if I was writing the opinion, what I would say is we're gonna apply Hardy, that's the status quo ante. In this instance, it's an easy application of Hardy because all of the First Amendment interests that Dr. Merriweather is advocating for are at their height in this situation. We do not rule out the fact that a professor might need to be able to express their views by using sex reflective pronouns and titles in other contexts. We're not saying that, but this is the easy case. Now, if you want the bright lines, you know, there's a couple on the margins. When a professor is engaged in purely gratuitous harassment, like as in the Bunnell case, then that's obviously off limits. And the university has all the authority in the world to stop gratuitous harassment. That's not this case. On the other end, you've got the school either compelling a professor to speak its words or denying them the ability to say the words that they wish on something related to what they're talking about in the classroom. That's really the apex of where the First Amendment interest arises. Anything in the middle, we're going to have to balance it.
So how do you address the university's argument in their brief that if they have to allow this, they'll also have to allow professors to engage in racist rhetoric?
Well, that's what this court upheld in Hardy. As long as that racist talk was not gratuitous, but it was part of a lesson helping the students understand the evils of racism, then yes, the university should have to allow that. The bigger problem is what happens if you flip that. If you rule in favor of the university and have and conclude that they have the ability to compel speech and compel silence, they could compel professors to use racist language, or they could compel professors to say that Amy Coney Barrett is anti-LGBT.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. What if a professor wanted to use racist language? Would the university have to allow them to do so?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the first part of that question?
What if a professor, so you flipped it wisely, in my opinion, and said condemning racism, but what if they wanted to use racist language and the university perceived them to be using racist language and upsetting the students, creating, quote unquote, a hostile environment?
Well, that's exactly what happened in Hardy. And a student did allege that it was a hostile environment. And they went to the administration and they went to an important alumni, a contributor, donator to the university, and they all went to the board of trustees. And even in that situation, the Sixth Circuit under the Pickering balance said that the speech was protected.
What if the university said no professor, no coach, no one can use pronouns, period? You can use first names, you can use last names, but no pronouns. Would that be acceptable?
It would not be, because compelled silence is still compelled speech. And from Dr. Merriweather's perspective, as well as every other participant in this case, which I can explain, using the pronouns says something about his beliefs about human sexuality. In the First Amendment complaint, he addresses that in paragraphs 2, 204, but especially 310, that the use of pronouns is not just gratuitous. It's not just to identify a student. It's expressing his views about the nature of humankind. And we know that the school and the intervening student feel that way, because otherwise they wouldn't be objecting here. We even know that the intervener's council feels that way. Several of them use preferred pronouns on their website. And they wouldn't do that unless they felt that that was communicating something to the rest of the world about how they viewed gender ideology versus sex reflective pronouns and titles. So clearly it has meaning. It's more than just identifying a student. And you know, one thing I would note, just kind of in this discussion about the balancing and all that, we don't even get to the balancing unless you reverse the district court's erroneous holding that somehow Garcetti bans any First Amendment analysis in this context, unless you reverse the district court's holding that talking about gender ideology in the context of reflective, sex reflective pronouns and titles is not an issue of important public concern. I strongly encourage you to engage in that Pickering balancing here, but there are so many flaws in the district court's opinion that you need to unravel before you even get to that point. And we know that they have to be unraveled in this way, or otherwise the worst hypothetical that the university can come up with, you know, whether that's, you know, being derogatory towards African-American students or women students or whatever, if their right that there are no free speech rights here, then the school can compel professors to say those outrageous, offensive things. And we know that can't be right. So we've got to set this whole thing back on the Hardy Foundation where it belongs.
Can I, Judge McKeager, Judge Larson, do you mind if I move him to the free exercise unless you have any speech questions?
That's where I was going to. So.
Okay, so can I ask you about your free exercise? And the first thing I want to ask you is, why are the facts involving Department Chair Pauley in 2016 relevant to your claim in 2018?
Well, the course of the administrative proceeding was a 9-month process, and everything that happened in the course of that process is going to be relevant to how this court views animus. Obviously, the Pauley comment is one, but what I would really point you to.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but weren't the Pauley comments in 2016? So I'm trying, the policy was enacted in 2016, as I understand it. He went to see her. She then made some comments that are hostile towards religion. And my question, why are those relevant to what happened in 2018? Is she involved in the process? Where are the allegations she's involved, et cetera, in 2018?
But first I want to clarify one thing about the facts, that this policy was in place for a long time. And prior to this incident with student Doe, the university had never interpreted its policy as requiring professors to use preferred pronouns of any student. That goes to the vagueness claim on due process, because he had no way to know ahead of time that this was going to be prohibited. Pauley's comments were in the context of that policy discussion, the gender identity discussion. And at every step of the way, whether it was Pauley or whether it was Maurer, here, I've got the actual allegation here. It's paragraph 117 of the First Amendment complaint. In November 2016, Pauley is discussing the issues related to transgenderism and gender identity with Dr. Merriweather. And she claims that adherents to the Christian religion are primarily motivated out of fear. Now, Pauley is the one who then refers him up the chain to superiors for further investigation. And that culminates then with the provost, Bauer, basically comparing his views to an ethnic supremacist. Now, if-
I understand all those facts. I'm just trying to get a hold of, so she refers him up the chain in 2018. But I thought that was purely administrative. And is there any allegation she shared her views back in 2016 and 2018? Or how do they become relevant to what happened in 2018?
Sure. Keeping in mind that this is a motion to dismiss, and so we haven't had the opportunity to take discovery yet, the reasonable inference that you could draw in Dr. Merriweather's favor is that having had these hostile views and then being the one who referred them to her supervisors and then seeing the provost reflect some of those same views in his ethnic supremacist conversation, that those views were shared and adopted by her superior. That's how they're relevant. But you don't need to focus on her. You can focus on Maurer, the provost. And that alone would get you across the line with respect to hostility.
Did Pauley have any discretion not to refer him once he sort of came and put this at issue? Did she, or I guess once she gets some sort of a complaint, does she have any discretion not to refer him, or is it just administrative?
I don't think the record is clear on that.
Okay.
How do we deal with your allegation in paragraph 46 that she was involved in the action against Dr. Merriweather? So in 46, you list them and you include her and say she consulted with the others and enforce the policies against him.
So that's on an information and belief. We know that this group of people together represented the administrative chain that resulted in the ultimate discipline, which was the letter of censure in his file. But until we take depositions of those folks, get discovery of their emails, I can't tell you specifically what they did in that process.
Can I ask you a different question, which is with respect to their compelling interest argument, how do you distinguish Harris Funeral Homes?
A couple of ways. First, Harris Funeral Homes obviously was in the Title VII context, and the Supreme Court's holding in that case was merely that you can't fire someone simply for being transgender. As the U.S. government has taken the position in several Title IX cases, the interests are very different here. For example, it's not sex discrimination, according to the U.S. government, to prohibit a biological male who identifies as female from competing against and beating all of the girls in track races, as is happening in Connecticut and in Idaho. And so Title IX requires universities to take sex into consideration. You know, what's more, if you're just talking about discriminatory policy anyway, it still can't have the effect of prohibiting protected speech. That's what this court held in Dambro. And even more on point, I direct you to the Telescope Media case that we discuss at page 55 of our opening brief. And that's the Eighth Circuit decision involving a Minnesota state anti-discrimination ordinance that court could not be applied in such a way to prevent videographers from having their free speech and free exercise rights violated by creating content that celebrated same-sex marriage.
Any other questions for Mr. Bursch? Okay, thank you for your argument. You'll have your rebuttal time. I think counsel for the university is going first, correct, Mr. Carriage?
That is correct, Judge DePaul.
Okay, you may proceed.
May I please call Paul Carriage on behalf of the Shawnee State defendants. There's lots of different routes the court could take to affirming the district court's judgment, but the most direct route on each of the three groups of claims, assume for the sake of argument that Garcetti has an academic freedom exception, and then rule that the academic freedom exception means this substantive debate or scholarship that's germane to the subject matter of the lecture. That's Hardy. That's the case that my friend on the other side relies on. And it actually states that the lecture subject matter is really important, not just everything that happens in the classroom.
So would Professor Merriweather be allowed to discuss gender identity in the classroom?
So let's assume that there is an exception to Garcetti for academic speech, and that speech would fit roughly within the syllabus, then yes. Professor Merriweather could...
Why couldn't he note his view on the syllabus?
Because announcing a view about the students is different to engaging in an academic discussion.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but is he announcing a view about the students or his own view? I thought what he wanted to do was announce his own view on gender identity.
Right, his own view is necessarily a violation of the discrimination policy at the university though.
So then why could he talk?
You just said he could discuss his own view in the course of the lecture.
He can engage in an academic debate. And if that involves his own view in the course of a lecture, and there's an exception to Garcetti, then that's fine. But on the syllabus, it's different.
So you're saying in the discussion in class, he can include in that discussion an expression of his own view?
Yeah, as part of a balanced academic debate, assuming that fits.
Okay. So if he can express his own view in the lecture, why can't he express his own view in the syllabus?
Because any purported academic freedom exception is limited to germane to the subject matter of the lecture or academic scholarship. And I don't think anyone's arguing that academic scholarship is really part of this. So announcing something on a syllabus is not germane to the subject matter of a lecture because it isn't part of a lecture at all. Give you an example.
Wait, Mr. Carriage, let me ask you a question. So it has to be germane to the lecture under yours. So could Shawnee State require like a math professor before class to praise the president of the university or praise the president of the United States?
Well, then there would be some questions. There's much bigger questions about whether that's part of a job task, and I think then you'd have to go through the Garcetti analysis.
Okay, well, what
on the front end?
What if, in their view, they wanted to create a non-hostile environment in the classroom, and in the university's view, it meant that the professor had to start every class, to use your friend on the other side's example, with Black Lives Matter? Could they compel professors to do that in math classes where it's not germane to the subject?
So as part of his job responsibilities?
Yes. It's an administrative task the university wants done to further their non-discrimination policy.
So I think that would fail Garcetti I think the university would just be incorrect in stating that was a job responsibility.
But
it seems that would just be outside the boundaries of the job.
But But why is that so? So the university, let's say the university has had some racial tensions in the past. They want to get across this message that this is an inclusive university, safe place for people to learn. And so every classroom begins with a professor's affirmation that Black lives matter. And maybe the students also need to say it. We all affirm that Black lives matter. And that's it. And then they go on and they learn calculus.
Well, the
why is that outside the job description?
Because I think it's I guess if the university wanted to put that in their in the contract or something.
It's in the
I'm sort of having trouble imagining that this is a situation that could arise. So that's why I'm struggling a little bit.
I suppose in a university as well, certainly in elementary schools, high schools, and middle schools, they start each day with the Pledge of Allegiance, right? So why couldn't you say we have to say the Pledge of Allegiance in the beginning? I know we already have a case on this, right? I'm wondering why this is different than that. Where have we had a case on the pledge?
Hopefully this answers the question. I think I'm going to go about in a kind of roundabout way, and I apologize for that. What we've got here is the in-class discrimination, and the in-class discrimination is different than it's directed at a particular student rather than directed at an ideology. And to sort of now, I mean, I know there's a case on the Pledge of Allegiance, but now we get this this situation where the professor's affirmatively stating a message, as opposed to, which is very different from, the message itself being discriminatory. I think that's the best I'm going to do in answering that question. I'm not sure I can offer a lot more.
Are you claiming that by using the pronoun of the student's choice, the professor is not delivering a communicative message?
Right. That is what we're claiming, that in terms of the academic freedom germane to the subject matter, that limitation, it's not a message to say...
Imagine, like some universities have done, you let the students pick their title or pronoun. Could the university require a Jewish professor to address a student as my Führer?
I think that would be in itself a violation of some other federal laws, because it would be so objectively offensive on race issues. I think there would be some significant problems with that.
Why is that race? I'm not sure I understand.
Oh, well, I mean, because you started talking about I'm sorry. I can't hear what you're saying. I'm sorry.
A Jewish professor addressing a student as my Führer. That's the title student wants.
Yeah.
So I think that is in itself objectively offensive. And then the student, to ask a Jewish professor to address a student.
I'm sorry, objectively offensive by what standard? Because the professor here says it's objectively offensive to make him use a pronoun which he inherently believes is not consistent with his religion.
And I think I understand now, but the university didn't ask him to use that pronoun. The university stated that he could use just first names or just last names and not use any pronoun for any student at all. So the idea that the professor was told to use certain pronouns is just belied by the record and the facts in the...
I'm sorry, you're still not answering my question, which is, my question is, they allow the students, as we all know, because there's famous cases, Your Highness or whatever, they allow the students to use the title of their choice. Could the university force a Jewish professor to call a student my Führer?
And I think the answer to that is no, because I think that would be a job responsibility task for the professor, and the university would be mandating something that in itself would be reasonably or objectively deemed discriminatory against the professor.
And what you're saying here is, if a professor's religious views matter in certain circumstances like that one, but not in other circumstances like this one. And explain to me where that distinction comes from, because I don't see it in the Constitution or anywhere else.
Because here the professor was not asked to make statements that were against his religious beliefs. That's not actually what happened. The professor was given the opportunity to use just first names or just last names. And there is no allegation in the complaint that doing that would violate any religious belief of the professor. The allegation in the complaint are that the professor doesn't want to use gender identity pronouns as opposed to gender assigned at birth pronouns, but the university allowed the professor to not use pronouns at all. So every claim related to forced use of pronouns is belied by the allegations in the complaint and the documents attached thereto.
Mr. Karich, is it actually possible to conduct a lecture without using a Socratic lecture without using any pronouns? So I get how it could go. Smith, Jones, I call Smith, I call in Jones, but then I want to ask Jones what Jones thinks of what Smith says. Do I have to do it that way? Because I can't say, what do you think about what he said? I have to say, and what if there are 400 students in my class? Like how many students are, I just don't know whether it's possible to conduct a lecture like that without ever using a pronoun. It's a standard part of speech.
So just to clarify, the professor wouldn't be barred from using pronouns for non-students. So if a philosophy professor wants to talk about Descartes or Immanuel Kant, then fine, use pronouns. It's the uneven use of pronouns or the unequal use of pronouns for students, that's the problem. So simply saying your colleague, what do you think of your colleague's comment? That then there's no pronoun. And language has changed over time and we've all been asked to use different nomenclature for different things. And that's what happens, that language changes slightly. And now we have terms.
You understand their complaint that it's almost impossible to get, I don't know that a person could get rid of pronoun use after as many years as Professor Merriweather has lived. It's a natural instinct. And what you're saying is one slip up. So, okay, no pronouns, one slip up and he can be fired. I mean, even if it's like Judge Larson said, you're talking about Smith and Jones who have nothing to do with this. And then you say to Jones, what do you think of what he just said?
So to clarify, and this is actually an issue precisely in this case, inadvertent slip-ups are not going to create a problem for the professor. In fact, it's I think 3427 of the district court record, there's a discussion by one of the people in the administration, I believe it's Dave Zender, about the professor is not being disciplined for an inadvertent slip-up because—
You're telling me if he inadvertently slipped up with Doe, he wouldn't be disciplined. What are you going to do? You're going to inquire into, you're going to go through a whole hearing on whether it was inadvertent?
Well, the policy requires the statement to be both objectively and subjectively offensive. So I think you would start with, is one slip up objectively offensive, especially if it's corrected properly afterwards and not corrected by just another different form of discrimination?
Okay, but a
proper correction would really...
What about multiple slip-ups, right? So the more times you slip up, the more times it looks like it's intentional, right? So one slip-up, maybe not three slip-ups, now he's in trouble?
Right, well, if a pattern of behavior is that the slip-ups, as we're referring to them, if that pattern of behavior is consistent and repeatedly using pronouns in a way that is offensive, then eventually you're going to get to, that doesn't look like an accident anymore.
But you also said that if the so-called slip up would be not actionable if it was corrected. So if you refer to Doe, in your view, mistakenly as he, then the professor has to then affirmatively say, I'm sorry, I meant she, which is compelled speech.
Well, again, we've got the I mean, we'd still get to the, got to go past the thresholds of the academic freedom exception to get there. But what I actually said was that would be seen as inadvertent, especially if the professor then corrected. So if the professor says, "Sir, I'm sorry, though," which I think is the allegation in the complaint, and then uses that same Smith Jones with no parameters for everyone else, then it looks like an inadvertent slip up. If the professor does that four times a class in every class, then it doesn't look like an inadvertent slip up anymore. It looks like a way of expressing the discriminatory language and then sort of hiding behind an apology afterwards. And then there's going to be degrees in between, which is where the court's really not going to get involved, presumably, in determining the nuances of the details of every single minor warning letter rather than a firing at a university. My time's up here, so I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Can I just ask you one quick question? In conducting the Title IX investigation, did the university talk to anybody in Professor Merriweather's class other than Merriweather and Doe?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask you two other questions? One is, in talking about the Title IX investigation, you initially concluded it was a hostile environment, but that was later changed. Am I correct about that?
I believe, and I want to make sure I get this right. I believe that there was the original statement was it was a hostile environment. And then I believe that on the final level of review, that was changed to some other form of discrimination, but I can't remember offhand what the second determination was.
So you no longer think it's a hostile environment, correct?
In communications with the school, my understanding is that they would not agree with that, the change, and would say that it was a hostile environment.
Even though they said otherwise by the
allegation. Well, that later down the line, and I think that there was a designee of one of the presidents who said that, but I think this really is a hostile environment case.
Can I ask you one other question? It's your position in your brief, at least, that Title IX compelled the university to adopt its gender identity policy. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's reasonable for the university to adopt the policy it did because of Title IX. And I think the law on...
Go ahead.
The law on gender identity at the time the policy was adopted wasn't particularly well clear. Now, Bostock proves, and there's been a subsequent 11th Circuit case that proves that the university was very wise to adopt this policy.
So I ask you then, Title IX, if in your view Title IX somehow compels it, does Title IX compel that a university like Notre Dame adopt such pronoun policies? And could you make priests teaching class do so?
I think the policy at Shawnee State absolutely, because the policy at Shawnee State isn't that the professor must use the pronouns. The policy is I'm going to phrase this in a negative, but how it played out was the professor was told, don't use the wrong pronoun.
So Title IX.
You must use the gender preferred pronoun. So you can use first names and then avoid the problem.
And this is my last question. By your argument, Title IX trumps both the free exercise clause, the establishment clause, and even the free speech clause of the First Amendment. We've got like a whole, like throw the First Amendment out when it comes to Title IX.
Well, when it comes to compelling interests, I think this court, I think it was Harris Funeral Homes, said that complying with federal law is a compelling interest. So it doesn't trump the First Amendment. The First Amendment just wouldn't apply here because that compelling interest would be folded into Pickering, a Pickering balancing test.
And you concede that was a Title VII case, as Mr. Birch said.
Bostock was a Title VII case, yeah. And okay. Harris Funeral Homes was as well. Yes. Yeah. There's been subsequent.
Okay. Judge McKeague, anything further?
No.
Judge Larson?
No.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carriage. Counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Adam Unikowski, and I'm here on behalf of the interveners. I'd like to just begin by diving into some of the questions and the concerns that the court expressed to my colleague. I certainly understand that it seems outrageous to the First Amendment to force people, Jewish professors, to address students as Führer and things like that. And I think the question is why that violates the First Amendment. What's the doctrinal tool that allows the court to reach that conclusion, and whether that applies here. So I think that the right way to look at that hypothetical is to say that it would violate the First Amendment to force anybody, not just a university professor, to address Jewish people as Führer. So I think it would be unconstitutional to force a high school teacher to do that, or someone at the DMV, or anyone else.
Why? What is unconstitutional? We don't just say it's unconstitutional. What gives us the hook?
Is it exercise
or free speech?
I would say that's free speech, potentially also free exercise because it's about religion, but certainly a free speech violation. And the question is why that's the case. And I think that there's two things to say about that that I think would distinguish it from the facts of this case. So first of all, I think that in that kind of scenario, you couldn't really treat it as part of the person's job duties to address people as Führer. And I don't think that governments can evade the Supreme Court's decisions that hold that you can't force loyalty oaths by simply defining them as part of job duty. So for instance, the Supreme Court has held in a number of cases that in general, you can't force people to adhere to a loyalty oath as a condition of public employment, not just professors, anybody, right? That's just a rule the Supreme Court has stated. It's a First Amendment violation to do that.
I'm sorry, I missed the connect. I understand the loyalty oath point, and that may answer my precedent question that I asked your friend, but why is using a title akin to a loyalty oath? And if it is, just explain that to me first.
Well, it's sort of a loyalty oath to Adolf Hitler if you're using the word Führer all the time. But even if you don't think so, there's a different point I'm trying to make here, which is that The different point I'm trying to make is that it's very hard to see how it's germane to the duties of a professor or someone at the DMV or anybody else to use the word Führer to refer to Jewish people. And so I just don't think that you can invoke Garcetti when you're imposing a requirement that seems to have no rational relationship to the person's actual job duties.
You're conceding that the title itself, you may be right about once we get to Pickering, but you're conceding the title itself has a communicative message.
Well, I mean, you're clearly communicating something. That doesn't answer the question as to whether it's part of the curriculum for purposes of a Garcetti exception, whether it's a matter of public concern. Obviously the utterance, Mr. Doe, is communicating that you're talking to Mr. Doe or Ms. Doe and referring to her as a man. So in a narrow sense, yes.
So you concede it has a communicative message.
Well, it's communicating is that there's a statement coming for this individual. I don't think that it's part of the curriculum. I don't think you can treat it as a matter of public concern.
Wait, Mr. Unikowski, what if we just flipped the hypothetical entirely? So Shawnee State has the view that sex is determined by biology, and that is the position of the university in this debate. They've come down on that side. They think it's harmful to students to address them in any other fashion. And so they forbid their professors from referring to students in any way other than a title that conforms to biology rather than gender identity. The professor says that's totally wrong. I want to respect students' self-identified gender identity. I want to create a safe space in the classroom for them. I want to refer to them the way they want to be referred. University says no. This case comes out differently or not?
Not from the professor's perspective. I don't think that's a First Amendment violation of the professor either. Maybe the student would be able to assert a claim that they're being discriminated against because of the rule. But no, I think that the professor, I mean, we have to be consistent here. And so we're going to be consistent. It's not part of the curriculum. So any academic speech exception to Garcetti wouldn't apply. Look, I think what the court should do, if the court is concerned about forcing people to use titles that they don't believe, whether things like Führer and the hypotheticals like that, the correct rule has got to apply to all public employees. I don't really think it makes sense to have one rule on this issue for professors and a different rule for anyone else. To the extent there's going to be a professor-specific rule, which is the only way that plaintiffs have proposed to get around Garcetti, it's got to be that's something that's part of the curriculum. And I just, it's very hard to understand how merely referring to a particular student as Mr. Doe, or just Doe as the complaint alleges, is really part of the learning experience. Like, I just think it's, it can't be the case that the student to whom this is addressed, our client, Doe, is really having her learning experience enhanced by being referred to as a man or being referred to by Doe only, nor do I think that the students within earshot are really learning anything. And that's really the doctrinal hook that plaintiffs have offered. They seem to agree that under Garcetti, this would be a permissible rule, but for this special exemption for university professors only. But I just don't think it fits the facts of this case to do that. So I think what the court should say is, look, you know, it's clearly not the case that that public employers can, you know, force Jews to express adherence to Hitler through their statements, regardless of whether they're a professor or a high school teacher or anyone else. But this sort of non-discrimination policy, just in terms of how the professor is referring to people in class, falls within Garcetti. I don't think there's a dispute, at least under the free speech clause, that the police officers and the custodians on campus could be required to adhere to the policy. And in terms of the academic speech exception, it's just not really part of the curriculum. I think that's the right doctrinal way to think about this case.
What do you do about the fact that the university wouldn't allow Professor Merriweather to include the explanation on his syllabus? So he said, I'll comply with your rule. That seems to comport with your understanding of Garcetti, but I want to explain that I'm doing this under protest.
All right. If I can make 2 points about the syllabus, if the court will indulge me. So the first point I'd make is that I think it's a little bit of a red herring, because I don't think the relief that plaintiff requested in the complaint is just to allow him to express his views on the syllabus. If you look at what he's actually asking for in this lawsuit, one, he's asking to remove the warning, which was not about the syllabus, it was about the differential treatment in class. And then two, he's asking to just invalidate the non-discrimination policy as a whole, rather than allow himself to complain about it on the syllabus. So, you know, I understand his concern. I understand that sounds like a matter of public concern, just criticizing the policy as a whole, but I don't construe his complaint as asking for the right to do that. And if the court thinks that that's a First Amendment violation, not letting him put it on the syllabus, we certainly would ask the court to distinguish between that allegation and the distinct allegation that the First Amendment requires him to use the pronouns. I guess
concede. I like the way you got around it. You and Mr. Bursch sounded similar on that point, that neither of you think it's that pertinent, but I guess, do you concede that it would be a First Amendment violation to bar him from putting it on the syllabus?
So I don't concede that, and I know that you might disagree, but let me just explain why I don't concede that.
When you do that, can you also explain if you also would say that he can't discuss gender identity in class?
So I definitely don't think that. Our client, Ms. Doe, and Seth, we have never argued that these topics shouldn't be discussed in class. We think they should be discussed in class from all perspectives. We do not want to have an orthodoxy on academics. That's never been our position. But let me just talk about the syllabus specifically. So I do think there's an argument that with regard to the syllabus itself, then there's a Garcetti problem for plaintiff, because that's a university commission document laying out university course requirements. I think a university could permissibly say, look, you can express your disagreement with the policy in class, out of class, anywhere, but on the specific university document that lays out course requirements, the university will say what's on there. It's not the right forum to air your grievances against the
university. He could come in every day and say, look, there's some students in here that want me to address them with the wrong pronoun or whatever he wants to say, and here are my objections to it, and then he could teach class, and that would be protected, but one time on the syllabus wouldn't.
So, you know, under the broadest view of Garcetti, in which there's no speech, that the academic freedom right belongs to the university, neither the syllabus nor the in-class speech would be protected. I understand there's some concern about the panel about this. And so if the panel is uncomfortable about that, if the panel thinks there's a constitutional right to express one's views on the syllabus, then that would also extend to what happens in class. That is not, I don't think that's distinguishable, right? So I do think, taking a step back, a university is allowed to say in general, on the syllabus, it's not the right forum for professors to air their grievances, or else you can have a constitutional right to say on the syllabus that the pay policy is too high, is unconstitutional, or that I should have gotten tenure or something. I think a university can say, look, this is the official university issued document for a university course. And so we're gonna say, here's what you put on the syllabus. It's not the forum to air your disagreement with policies. But look,
I'm having been a professor for many, many years, I've never thought of the syllabus as university mandated in any way. So it just, you know, I put put on there, I hope you appreciate at the end of this course that this is a, we have a government of laws, not of men. That was my aspirations for my students. And that it just seems odd to me that you would think it's a university dictated piece of paper. Maybe it is.
I think
what to write on it.
I see my time has expired. I'll just answer the question and then I'll pipe down. I think universities do sometimes require professors to put particular policy statements, grading and other policies on the syllabus, recognizing that's the university that's offering the
course. Sure, I suppose it could be.
So I think it's hard to say that the First Amendment guarantees a professor and that would be a compelled speech claim under plaintiff's view. So I'm not sure that's right, but I see that's my time has expired.
But you seem to be saying that while you can't put it on the syllabus, the university can order him to just refer to people by last names, but the professor would then be permitted in class at the beginning of the course or every day to say, I'm referring to you only by your last name. I think that's rude, but I'm required to do so. And I disagree with the policy for these reasons. That would be okay.
I think it's not
okay in the syllabus, but it is okay if the same words are spoken in class?
We're not saying that violates Title IX or the policy. We've never argued that violates the policy at all. Our client just doesn't want to be referred to as a man or referred to differentially from other students by only using her last name and using, you know, Mr. or Ms. to every other student. That's all we've ever asked for in this case.
Can I ask one question in regards to that? As I understand your brief, under your interpretation of Title IX, sex-based distinctions are illegal. And so wouldn't that mean that in accord with the student's self-perceived gender, they'd have to let biological males play women's sports or be in women's dorms or use women's bathrooms, locker rooms, all those things?
I mean, these issues obviously are not presented in this case. In general, we think Title IX might require those policies. I understand there's privacy objections and other objections, which we don't think are material in these circumstances.
And then it would require Notre Dame or a Catholic school to do that as well.
No, I think that RFRA potentially would constrain the application of Title IX to religious institutions. It's a federal statute, so RFRA is an automatic exception to every federal statute. So I don't think that the rule would necessarily be the same for a religious institution.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Bursch, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. A couple of quick points. But both my friends on the other side said that you can't require a professor to call students by a particular title that's not germane to the school's mission and the job, but that's actually written into the university's policy. If you look at paragraph 18.4 of the policy that's issued here, this is at page ID number 769 of the district court record, you'll see in the definition of gender identity, it doesn't even mention pronouns. That's something they made up after the fact. What it does say is that gender identity includes what individuals call themselves. So if a student wanted to call themselves Your Highness or Jesus Christ, Your Lord, the school's position would be that a professor would have to use that language or otherwise they'd be in violation of the gender identity policy. We know that can't be right. My friend, Mr. Carriage, also tried to draw a line between simply speaking to a class and having a debate about a subject as though those things are different. But Hardy rejects that. Again, Hardy was this court's decision involving racist comments and sexual epithets in class. And the court said, even though this doesn't constitute pure public debate, it is still First Amendment protected speech. That's 260 F3rd at 679. My friend at the university also says that there's a difference between requiring someone to use preferred pronouns and requiring them not to use pronouns at all. But as I already mentioned, compelled silence is still compelled speech. The problem here is not just that the university is compelling Dr. Merriweather to use pronouns that he thinks are inaccurate and not consistent with the truth, but also that they're compelling him to be silent on things that he cares about. Mr. Unikowski then suggests that, you know, maybe when we're talking about tolerance and things like that, that's not actually part of the curriculum. Well, of course, tolerance can be part of the curriculum. I thought Judge Larson's hypo about the racial tensions on campus and requiring a professor to talk about Black Lives Matter at the beginning of each class to affirm that it's a safe environment is a perfect example of that. And then I also want to reject Mr. Unikowski's suggestion that somehow there's differential treatment that's going on here. It was Doe who was asking for differential treatment. It was Dr. Merriweather that wanted to treat every student the same by referring to them based on their biological sex. You know, it's been said that it's one thing to tax, it's another thing to regulate. It's uniquely bad for the government to put words in someone's mouth and to silence them. And all of the First Amendment concerns that the US Supreme Court's cases have discussed generally, but specifically in the education context, all come to bear when a university anti-discrimination policy forces a professor to speak the university's ideology and to be quiet about his own. And that's exactly what's happened here. So unless there are any further questions, I'll see the remainder of my time.
I have one. So we've been talking about the university says calling students by their first or last names would be okay. We've talked a lot about last names. We never talked about first names. So would it violate your client's scruples if Doe, I don't know what Doe's first name is, but let's say Doe's first name is Mary. So would your client also have an objection to that? I mean, Mary, I just think is a sort of stereotypical female name.
Well,
I just want to know whether the first name policy is something that would be acceptable to your client.
One of Dr. Merriweather's attempts to compromise, and remember he did this several times, was to offer to use Doe's preferred legal name and to avoid pronouns with Doe while using sex reflective titles and pronouns with everyone else in class. And that's something that the university rejected. Now, even there, if the university compelled him to do that, I think it's a potential First Amendment problem, but he bent over backwards to do what he could to respect Doe. And you know, one thing that's kind of lost in this whole thing, well, two things that are lost. First, the standard that the university has to demonstrate to show that there was discrimination under their own policy. Their policy describes discrimination as depriving a student of an educational benefit. And in all the discussion that we've had today about hostile environments and being mean and things like that, they've never discussed how Doe was denied an educational benefit when they were allowed to participate regularly in the class, got a good grade, you know, passed, the very kinds of things that this court has talked about in cases like Hardy. But the other is the motivation for Dr. Merriweather. They try to paint him as someone who's trying to malign and single out this student. And that's not true. His compromises and his inquiries show that he was trying to facilitate a situation where he wouldn't have to profess something he believed untrue while still respecting the student. You know, and keep in mind that his whole philosophy is love and care for the students. He thinks that affirming someone in gender dysphoria, which can cause lifelong problems and increase suicide rates and things like that, is not compassionate. And yet it's the university that is shutting him down and not allowing him to discuss the very compassion that motivates his speech. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Birch. Any further questions, Judge McKeague?
No, thank you.
Judge Larson?
No.
Well, thank you all very much for your thoughtful briefs and argument in this case. They've been excellent. We wish we could have done this in person, but with the present circumstances, we're sorry we can't, but we appreciate you all accommodating us and doing it via Zoom. And thank you again, and your case will be submitted.